Welcome to the Friends with Money podcast, brought to you by Money Magazine, creating financial freedom for Australians since 1999.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for another episode of Friends with Money, Money Magazine's podcast to help you earn, save, and achieve your financial goals. My name is Tom Watson, a senior journalist here at Money Magazine. And as always, it is a pleasure to be with you. I must admit that I am a bit of a serial checker of my investments. I know it's a bad habit, but sometimes I'll log into my brokerage app every day or, you know, sometimes multiple times a day. So I'm pretty up to speed on how my shares and ETFs are tracking. What always comes as a surprise, though, and a pleasant one at that, is when those quarterly dividend notifications hit my inbox. I always forget about them without fail. But today, we are not going to forget about dividends. In fact, on today's episode of Friends with Money, we are going to take another dive into growth and dividend stocks. But this time, we're really going to shine a spotlight on the dividend side of the equation. Anyway, enough rambling from me. I'm very pleased to say that joining us today to talk all about dividends and stocks is Jonathan Urich, co-founder and CIO of investment fund DivGrow. Jonathan, very warm welcome to you. Thank you so much for joining Friends with Money.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
Jonathan, very quickly to start, what do we mean when we talk about dividend stocks and growth stocks? What's the difference?
So typically in the industry, people will think about the category of dividend stocks as those companies that pay some, most, sometimes all of what they earn out to shareholders by way of a dividend, and that they keep that separate for the most part from what they consider growth stocks, which are companies that almost exclusively or exclusively reinvest everything that they earn back into expanding the business. Now, there is a segment that we believe is overlooked, and that is dividend growth stocks. They're companies that primarily reinvest what they earn, but they do pay a dividend. And because they're priced and behave primarily like a growth stock, they're able to compound their dividend at very rapid rates. And as a result, they don't fit neatly into either basket. And we think there's enormous opportunity there from both a fundamental performance side and from the emotional side that I'm sure we'll get to.
Oh, it sounds like a win-win for investors then, that's for sure. So fundamentally then, and you kind of already started getting into this a little bit, Jonathan, what are the advantages of building a portfolio with dividend stocks in it? You know, why would someone want to do it?
So we believe that to succeed in investing, there are two key requirements, though the industry and everybody participating basically only focuses on one. And the first one is the objective merits of the instrument, whether it's a stock, a fund, an ETF, you choose your instrument. And that is extremely important. That's also why everybody spends their time doing it. And there's a second very important component, which is the emotional framework or the emotional journey that an investor goes on once they've selected that instrument to make sure that they can actually get the compounding benefits that they anticipated. It is a well-documented phenomenon that investors, by and large, underperform the instruments that they participate in, whether those are stocks, ETFs, funds, it doesn't seem to matter. It's just the extent to which they underperform. And so what we do is we try and blend for the success in both. We look to an enormous body of academic work dating back to the late 50s and early 60s out of MIT, spearheaded by Professor Myron Gordon and his team, which subsequently went on to win a Nobel Prize in economics. And what they found was that there is objective merit in dividend paying and dividend growth companies. The first aspect is that as a category, companies that pay dividends outperform those that don't, acknowledging that there are outliers. The second development of their research found that those companies that raise their dividend each year outperform those that simply pay. Of course, it makes a lot of sense that if you raise your dividend every year, your business is flourishing. There's basically one way to keep growing your dividend every year for a long time, and that's when the business is moving forwards at a healthy rate consistently. And then they found that those companies that grow their dividend at the fastest rate outperform the most. And they built this model, which today is known as the dividend growth model or the Gordon growth model, and it essentially stipulates that over time and at points in time, the sustained rate of change in the dividend is equated by a similar rate of change in the price. So to put that as an example, if you can identify a company and it grows its dividend at, let's say, 13 or 14% a year on average for a long period of time, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, you should expect that the share price will go up at the same rate over time. And now, if one is able to find those, and we'll probably get to that, there's an enormous emotional benefit that comes from watching dividends grow. Because the environment for the investor is a difficult one. You have to be faced with moving prices all the time, which sometimes are moving because of the fundamentals of the business, and sometimes because of macro events that have little or nothing to do with the business. And every day you're encouraged to make or not make decisions. Maybe you act, maybe you don't act. But if you focus on the trajectory of this dividend, the fact that it is announced and it's meaningfully higher than the same time last year, and then you become entitled and then you receive it quarter after quarter after quarter, you're rising up on a staircase up and to the right. Whereas the price is moving up and to the right along the same journey, but looks like a roller coaster rather than a staircase. And we blend those two in this dividend growth methodology, which we believe has very well-founded objective merit of instrument and has a feedback or reinforcement approach that keeps you along that journey better.
I love that analogy, Jonathan, that staircase and that, well, that roller coaster as well. It's a lovely way of illustrating it for people, especially, you know, obviously the positive side of it. You kind of mentioned this and it's a good segue. I'm interested in how, I guess, everyday investors can actually work out which companies, which stocks are good for dividends. Is it just by the dollar figure that they pay out each quarter, or is there something else, some other metric that's actually worth looking at?
It's a fantastic question, because almost everything that you'll read about conventional dividend-based thinking, the first question is how much? What is the yield today? How much am I getting? We think that's entirely the wrong question. How much doesn't account for how fast will this grow? Which is a much better question in our opinion. How fast will this grow means that you are asking about the forward development of this business. And if a company is able to compound its dividend at a high rate, really there's only one way they can do that. And that is that the business becoming more productive, more valuable in its dividend paying capacity, aside from the emotional benefits that come from that. It's actually an opportune time to discuss this, because just recently, some very widely held, supposed dependable dividend payers in the Australian context cut their dividends, whether that's BHP or Woolworths or Domino's Pizza. And I'm not faulting those companies or the investors in them, but if you were holding them for their dividend paying credentials, for the receipt of that income, and all of a sudden you're faced with less, your income is lower, that's a problem. Your share price over time follows the dividend. So the feedback that you got, both from the company's dividend and from the price, makes it difficult to stay the course, even if they turn out to be good. Mm-hmm. And what we are arguing is, instead of asking how much today, it's how much can this become? How fast? How consistent?
So you mentioned a couple of examples there, Jonathan, of I guess companies that have disappointed a little bit in the last month or so. Can you maybe give us some more examples of you know, within the Australian context, of companies that, you know, are quite positive when it comes to dividends, you know, that have the kind of attributes that you've been talking about?
So we don't actually own any Australian companies. We look. We haven't been able to find ones that meet all of our criteria, though there's some that meet some or many of our criteria. But philosophically, what we believe one should look for, whether that's in the Australian context or elsewhere, are companies that are doing something that is very critical, whether that is to an end consumer or to a business consumer, something that can't be substituted away easily. They're typically the standard. They are primarily reinvesting in their business rather than paying everything out. So we're looking for very low payout ratio. We're looking for the type of management and ownership structure often controlled by a family that is thinking about very long-term horizons rather than trying to optimize next quarter or next year. And as a result, they often invest more astutely over a longer horizon and build a cherished bond with their shareholders. So we're looking for low payout ratio, high reinvestment that is sheltered and very predictable. We like things that are selling something where the price to value equation is very compelling for the customer. So they're not doing something to their customer, they're providing something for their customer. And that's a very important distinction, often very latent, unexploited pricing power. And while history is a good guide, this isn't a mechanical process, because a mechanical process will take you to the dividend greats of the past, and the past is past. It's often a good starting point, but what we don't want to see is a decaying rate of dividend growth, a company that once paid an increasing dividend of 15% per year rising, and then it goes down to 5 or 0 or negative. So one needs to think about, what is the forward trajectory? Is there a long runway? And is this company ideally positioned to capture that runway?
Jonathan, one of the, the big questions that I had come into this was, has been inspired by a lot of articles I see and posts on social media, basically all within the same vein of, this is how much income you can generate from dividends if you invest X money in X company, And often they're kind of astronomical sums. So I guess for regular investors, is it possible to generate a decent income from dividends?
Yes, it is entirely possible, but the time frame is an important consideration. So as we've been discussing, the best form of income is a rising income. And the faster it's rising, the safer it is. Now, typically, companies that are able to grow their dividend at a very high rate trade, but the market recognizes this and therefore prices them with a tight yield. To the, let's call it, first level dividend thinker, it doesn't look like a robust income stream because the yield is a bit too low relative to something else. But the rate of growth of that dividend has a triple benefit. One is, the fact that it's growing fast means that your income is building fast, which is a good thing. More income rising quickly is clearly a good thing. Two, like we said before, share price over time follows the trajectory of the income or of the dividend. And therefore, if a dividend is rising fast, the share price is likely to rise at a healthy rate in tandem. And the third benefit is the psychological one or emotional one, which is the journey for the investor is much more palatable if you consistently get this feedback, this secret language that the company is communicating with you. It's telling you how it's been doing and what it thinks the future holds by raising its dividend, and it makes the investor feel better along that journey. Now, contrast that with a high opening yield that doesn't grow. If it doesn't grow, it's much less safe. And therefore, the surprise is likely to be negative when it gets cut and the share price is likely to go with it. And the feedback to the investor is not one that makes you feel warm and fuzzy, but probably the other way. And so to the extent that people can, we completely understand that sometimes there's a very pressing present need for income. But to the extent that one can, one should think about, what am I giving up by going for that income today? It's a compounded or hyperbolic change that I'm giving up for that income today. To the extent that one can, we believe that one is much better off going for a high rate of growth in the dividend than simply a high dividend today.
I think you've kind of explained throughout, Jonathan, the merits of, stocks that have both a dividend and a growth focus. So Is that really important for people to, appreciate that a diversification of their portfolio can be important and useful, and that perhaps relying just on, growth-focused assets or dividend-focused assets might not kind of achieve what they're looking for in the long run?
It's a good question. And actually, inside the dividend growth space, you can be very well diversified. As an example, today we own 30 companies and they span medical devices, critical software, niche distribution, aftermarket parts for air conditioners or aviation, payment processes, etc. There's actually quite a wide spread that one can be diversified. And diversification is great, but to a point, because there is a limit of good ideas, things that have extreme objective merit. And so when one finds a really good idea where one has identified all of the makings of a rapid dividend grower at far into the future, where a dollar of income today will be 5 or 10 or 100, 10, 15, 20, 30 years later, one should consider concentrating the maximum rather than the minimum while they are still able to withstand the emotional component that comes with that. So we look at diversification as very beneficial, but idea number 50 is probably not going to be as good as idea number one. And an allocation to this space is very, very constructive and can be surprisingly diversified.
Jonathan, I feel like we've covered a ton of ground already today, but before we let you go, it would be silly of me not to ask, given that you are an expert in this area, whether you have perhaps a tip or multiple tips or some words of wisdom that you can leave our listeners with.
I'll go back to that sort of founding thought for us of the two key components of successful investing. One is the objective merits of the instrument, and two is the emotional compatibility that every person has with that instrument. And everybody is different. Everybody is somewhere along that emotional resilience spectrum or continuum. And while everybody spends 99 or 100% of the time that they think about investing on the financial merits of the instrument, they should turn their attention, at least philosophically, to this concept of to be able to go on that journey, that compounding journey in any instrument, there will be ups and downs along the way. There might be a COVID outbreak, which is unexpected, or there might be a presidential election that resolves itself differently to consensus. It might be an RBA decision that is up, down, the same, unexpectedly, or unexpectedly relative to that individual's belief system at that point in time. And it is too late to think about how you will cope emotionally with that instrument in the moment. Going in, while doing your analysis, your thought process, your expected outcomes, you should also think, how am I likely to feel under different scenarios? And make sure that you properly calibrate what you own with how you're likely to own it, because otherwise you will fall victim to this phenomenon, which is there are quite a few decent instruments out there, but people generally fail to stick from A to Z along the compounding journey. And they look back and they say, had that happened, I knew everything I needed to know. And we believe that by turning your attention in advance and consistently through the journey to this emotional, the psychological component, in addition to the financial metrics or merits of the instrument, people position themselves for much greater success.
I think that is an excellent, excellent note to leave things off on today. Jonathan, many thanks for joining us on Friends of Money. It's been an absolute pleasure and been a great explainer. So thanks for so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Tom.
That is it for this episode of the Friends of Money podcast. But don't forget to jump on our website, moneymag.com.au, for your daily dose of financial news. Or you can go grab yourself a copy of the latest edition of Money Magazine in all good newsagents. As always, Friends of Money will be right back in your podcast feeds next week. So until then, my name is Tom Watson. Goodbye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Friends with Money podcast. For credible, independent, and easy to understand financial commentary, visit moneymag.com.au. Please remember that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are general in nature, and further independent advice and research based on your personal circumstances should be sought before making an investment decision.